Hello and welcome to Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. On today's programme, an Indian mother who needs round-the-clock police protection after taking on community leaders over an honour killing. Also, 4 months pregnant on the front line in Afghanistan, an American reporter who hid her condition to travel with the troops. And as Australia prepares to remember its war dead, the authorities plan to avoid a repeat of last year's outbreak of drunken nationalism. First, a court in the North Indian state of Haryana recently sentenced 5 people to death and 1 to life in prison over the so-called honour killing of a young couple 3 years ago. Manoj and Babli, who were from the same village, had run away from home to get married. Their relationship broke a sacred tradition in their Jat community, which forbids marriage within the same clan. Babli's family vowed vengeance, and days later, her body and that of her new husband were fished out of a canal. Honour killings are not uncommon in this part of India, but cases rarely make it to court, and it's even rarer for them to end in a conviction or a tough sentence. Campaigners believe this case will set a good example. But there's been outrage in the Jat community, where many people feel their traditions have been undermined by the verdict. Manoj's mother, Chandrapati, waged a lone and difficult battle to bring the culprits to justice. The BBC's Sohail Halim went to her village to meet her.
Chandrapati and her daughter live under 24/7 police protection, so real is the threat to their lives. Nearly 200 kilometers from Delhi, her village sits in the middle of unending wheat farms. This is where her son and daughter-in-law were killed. Her house on the periphery of Karora village is well fortified. The entrance is through a big steel door which is always kept locked from the inside, with 4 or 5 heavily armed police constables on guard. The police opened the door for me. It was extremely hot, and Chandrapati offered me water drawn from a hand pump, took me into an inside room, closed the door, and then in a very low but calm voice, told me her story.
Mataji, thank you very much for speaking with the BBC. Namaskar. When did you find out that Babli and Manoj had been killed?
We came to know after 10 days that they had been murdered. They left the village on April 6th and got married in Chandigarh a day later. But on the way back, a group of villagers kidnapped them from the bus they were travelling in. Manoj had called me to say that the villagers were following them and that they were in danger. When we called back a few minutes later, their phone was switched off. I was very worried.
Achha, so did you ever have an inkling that something like this could happen? Were any threats being issued?
Yes, we were being threatened. They were saying we will kill them both. And then a day after they were murdered, the village council ordered our social boycott. We were ostracized. Nobody was allowed to talk to us. And if they did, they faced a fine of $500.
Achato, what was your initial response? What went through your mind when you came to know that this had happened?
Our world came crashing down. But we still wanted to find their dead bodies, to perform their last rites. And then we came to know that 2 bodies had been found in a nearby canal. The police cremated them as unclaimed bodies. We identified them from their clothes. We recognized Manoj's shirt and Babli's shirt and trousers. And we also found the jewellery that we had gifted to Babli.
So, you are a widow. What made you take on the powerful village councils? And did you get any support from your extended family? Un logon ki taraf se koi help mili, koi madad mili?
We got no help from any relatives or friends. And we have borne all the expenses ourselves. When a mother loses a young son, that mother has to find the courage to fight for justice. These innocent children had been mercilessly killed. I had to ensure that their killers, these evil men, were brought to justice. My only support was from my daughter and a nephew.
Mataji, thank you very much for speaking with the BBC. Bahut shukriya ki aapne BBC se baat ki. Your daughter Rekha is here as well. Rekha, you have been through a lot over the last 3 years with your mother. How has life changed for you?
After this incident, we mostly stay at home. Because there is always this fear that something might happen. But the biggest change is that I had to give up schooling. Now I have to study at home. And wherever you go, to the farms or to the market, you always have the police accompanying you. It's very difficult.
Have you ever wished that Manoj had not married Bubbly?
No, never. But we do wish that they had not been murdered. They could have been allowed to stay away from the village. Then none of this would have happened. And Bubbly's family would not have been sentenced to death either.
This is wheat harvesting time in northern India. The farmers are busy in their fields. I wanted to find out what the local villagers felt about the whole affair. But I had been warned to tread with caution. The Jats are a so-called martial race. They have closed ranks and come out in full support of the girl's family. They don't think the killing of Manoj and Bubbly qualifies as murder. People here are really angry over the court's verdict. I saw some cab drivers whiling away their time. This is lean season for them. I got into their car and they soon bared their hearts to me.
Our court is not according to the society.
The court does not reflect the reality on the ground in our society. They have a very Western concept of justice. Now the couples will become more emboldened and crime will increase. And of course the councils will think twice before dispensing their brand of justice. This judgment is absolutely wrong. Who will bother to stop these lovers now?
But I still wanted to hear from the powerful village councils or Kha Panchayats. I called up one of their leaders who invited me to a council meeting being held in a town 70 kilometers away. By the time I reached there, the meeting had concluded, but the leaders were waiting for me. Satbir Singh told me what had been decided earlier.
Today we have decided to oppose the court's verdict tooth and nail. These people have not committed such a crime to deserve the death sentence. We will now demand a ban on marriages within the same clan and the same village. And we will pool our resources to support Bubbly's family in their fight for justice. The courts cannot be above the people.
The meeting was attended by both illiterate farmers and Jat intellectuals, but there was no difference of opinion. Community leader Dr. Om Prakash Dhankar is a very vocal critic of the court's judgment. He doesn't mince his words.
This is not punishment. This is a conspiracy to break up our social value system. Some organizations have been trying to attack the village panchayats, and now they have found an excuse. Ours is a cheap and quick system of dispensing justice.
But Dr. Dhankar, how can you possibly defend something like that happened in the case of Manoj and Bubbly? Two people lost their lives.
Actually, Manoj and Bubbly committed a heinous crime. They belonged to the same clan and same village. They were brother and sister. But the real culprit is Chandrapati, Manoj's mother. She encouraged Manoj and Bubbly to get married. She is the one who deserved this punishment.
The guilty verdict has been challenged in an appellate court and the community has openly promised support to the convicted killers. But despite that, activists say, this will remain a landmark verdict in the fight against honor killings. The victims will feel encouraged to make their voices heard and village councils will think twice before freely handing out their brand of justice.
Suhail Halim reporting from Haryana State in northern India. This is Outlook from the BBC World Service. I'm Matthew Bannister. Coming later in the programme, how the Australian authorities plan to stop their National Day of Remembrance turning into a drunken brawl. But now, in the autumn of 2007, New York Times reporter Elizabeth Rubin spent 2 months embedded with the US forces in eastern Afghanistan. She was an experienced correspondent who had travelled to the country a number of times before. But this trip was different because Elizabeth was 4 months pregnant. The US Army doesn't allow pregnant women into combat zones, so she had to keep her condition secret. She spent 2 months in harsh conditions with troops on the front line. By the time she returned to Kabul, she was 6 months pregnant and eventually went home to New York to give birth to a healthy baby girl. I asked Elizabeth why she took what some people would see as the irresponsible decision to go to a war zone whilst pregnant.
I'd passed through the first term of pregnancy and I talked to my gynecologist and she said, you know, you're perfectly healthy, everything is going well. And I just figured I wouldn't be there very long. I certainly didn't anticipate where I was going to be and what I was going to get into, but I just knew that I was healthy and I was just going to go on with my job the way many women that I knew did. So in the abnormalness of my life, it seemed normal.
Now, you said that you didn't know what it was going to be like when you got there. How did it turn out? Because you got into some pretty hair-raising places, didn't you?
That's right. It turned out that the place that I decided to stay in, because I met this young American captain in Kunar in the Korangal Valley, this happened to be the place where the most bombs were being dropped. And the day that I arrived there, they dropped a bomb on a house and some women and children were killed. And I spoke to him and I saw the place where they were, which was sort of basically on the side of a mountain in a little outpost. And I just thought, this is where I have to be. And this is the guy whose decisions I want to be writing about, because he is making the decisions every day and is thinking about it and going through all of the turmoil of it. And I guess I got so into the logic of the story that I was working on and the experience of these soldiers and the Afghans, and I felt very healthy. I was very good at mountain climbing by that point, that I just decided to stick it
out. Did you have any concerns about your child?
Of course I had concerns, in the sense that I was in a dangerous place.
And putting yourself under quite a lot of pressure, because you were going on very long hikes through the mountains, weren't you?
You know, that's true, but there's also, a lot of people do a lot of intense exercise and movement, and I think I just was feeling very healthy. And this will sound strange, and strange things do happen when you're pregnant. You go through all sorts of emotions and thoughts that you don't know are going to happen until you're actually carrying a child. And this, in retrospect, was unrealistic. But at the time, I also felt some kind of weird protection about having this life growing inside of me while I was in this place where so many difficult and terrible things were happening.
And did you have physical effects as well? Because often, you know, it's a bit of a strain being pregnant, a strain on your bladder, for example, a strain sometimes on your legs. Do you have any of those problems?
Yes. Well, of course, you have to pee every 5 seconds. I mean, so there's the challenge of finding places to go when you're on the side of a mountain with all male soldiers. That could be very difficult. There was a time when I was stuck in a Humvee for about 8 hours, and I had to use a little water bottle, and none of the soldiers knew that I was doing this because I was in the back. And then the other thing were that my ankles would swell. So at the end of the day, my ankles did look like sort of large grapefruits.
And I gathered that fleas were attracted to you for some reason.
Yes, I forgot about the fleas. I think we stopped counting. There were probably about 500 bites all over my stomach, because I think they're attracted to the blood. But everybody was consumed by the fleas. People wore flea collars, and it was a constant problem.
And did any of the soldiers guess that you were pregnant?
Apparently they did, but forgot about it quickly. They just thought, okay, she must be a little chubby or something. But the day that I was leaving, I told the captain, who'd become a friend at that point, and he was making fun of me for not being able to do something. And I said, well, you know, I am about to be 6 months pregnant. And he just was very quiet for a while and then said, you know, somebody had mentioned that in the beginning and I just couldn't believe it, and you're crazy.
Do you think that they might have been resentful if they found out that you were pregnant, because they were going into action with you, they were going into very dangerous places with you? You might have held them back. They might have been worrying about you.
Sure, that's definitely one of the reasons why I didn't tell anybody that I was pregnant, because I didn't want anyone to have that worry. I will tell you that everybody who goes with these soldiers, whether it's the chaplain, whether it's journalists, whether it's the contractors, becomes a burden for the soldiers. And unless you're, you know, a 19-year-old guy, it's very difficult to handle it, especially on the first day.
So when you came out of that combat zone and you got back to civilization, presumably one of the first things you did was to get a medical checkup, was it?
Yes, I went back to Kabul. A friend of mine had an Afghan friend who ran a little clinic where he did sonograms. There was no electricity in the city, and it was a kind of half-bombed-out building, and I was definitely worried by that point because I couldn't feel her moving. So I got a sonogram from him and saw her sucking her thumb, and it was pretty incredible.
And did you at that moment reflect back on what you'd been putting her through and think, wow, you know, that was a pretty extraordinary thing to do, to go into those places when you're carrying a baby child inside you?
Yes, of course I thought about it and thought, well, she'll have one hell of a story to tell.
And how is she now?
She's amazing. She's a completely precocious, adorable child. She's singing all the time and just a very, very happy, fantastic, healthy child.
And has her birth changed your view about your work? Do you think you would be more reluctant in future to go back to those dangerous places?
Well, I've been back to Afghanistan probably 4 or 5 times since her birth. And it's definitely, I am much more cautious. For instance, during the latest offensive in Marja in Helmand, many of my colleagues went, and because of the IEDs, the landmines, I didn't go. So there are some things that I'm not willing to do anymore.
Elizabeth Rubin speaking to me from New York, and you can read the article she wrote about her experiences via our website at bbcworldservice.com/outlook. Now, remembrance ceremonies around the world are usually somber affairs where people gather to remember their war dead. But Anzac Day, named after the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, is very different. The atmosphere is more akin to a carnival, and last year's commemorations in Sydney ended in drunken violence and 2 deaths. Well, the authorities are trying to keep control of this year's ceremonies, which will take place on Sunday. They'll mark the 95th anniversary of the ill-fated Gallipoli landings during the First World War, when thousands of Anzac troops lost their lives. A limit has been placed on the number of people who can take part in commemorative marches in some areas. But as our reporter Sharon Maskell has been finding out, it's a decision which hasn't met with everybody's approval.
This is the last post, a haunting sound played on a bugle, and it'll be heard at Anzac Day ceremonies throughout the world this Sunday. At the Shrine of Remembrance here in Melbourne, there'll be crowds of thousands. War veterans, families and children will stand here just before dawn to remember Australians who've gone to war. One of them will be Keith Hill. He's 89, and he went to fight the Japanese in New Guinea, just north of Australia, during World War II. He'll be here to remember his mates, who didn't come home.
Well, I joined the army when I was 20 year old. Then we went to New Guinea. I was up there for 8-9 months. I was just one of many others, and we depended on each other for our lives. When you were on a fighting patrol, naturally you went to kill. We had a job to do, and we just did it.
It must have been terrifying for you at times.
Oh, it was all terrifying all the time. We'd laugh like anything, and the next day we might be gone. On Anzac Day, we're there to remember the ones that we lost during the war.
Imagine sitting in a convertible, 100 kilometres an hour, on the open road, in your underpants.
Is that what it's like flying in this plane?
In winter it's worse.
Darryl Hill is Keith's eldest son. He's also been in the military. He used to be a pilot in the Royal Australian Air Force, and his pride and joy is Miss Scarlet, a silver vintage biplane he keeps in a hangar just outside Adelaide. This Sunday, he'll also be in Melbourne with his dad at the annual Anzac Day parade. He feels strongly about the tradition and the importance of remembering those who died.
Part of the reason I chose this aeroplane to restore, because it's pretty hard to find, there was a bit of a family connection. My grandfather trained on the grandfather of this aeroplane, so the grandson connection sort of worked. But more to the point, we've never, I think, paid tribute adequately to the people who went out and never came back. This is a flying tribute to them, a living, breathing, oil-dripping, flying tribute to them.
So on Anzac Day this year, your dad, Keith, will be marching. Will you be with him?
Yep, and so will all my brothers and sisters. I think that's a pretty important part of this whole thing. We're not there to steal any of the glory. That's not what it's all about, but to receive the baton that these old guys are passing from one generation to the next.
Ladies and gentlemen, or should I say friends, welcome again to our Anzac Day briefing. The Anzac tradition has never really been under more of a threat than it is at the moment by people who have, I believe, a misplaced sense of entitlement about what Anzac means to them.
But as rehearsals and preparations get underway, some organisers are concerned about the behaviour of some relatives in this year's Anzac Day parades. Last year, World War II veterans like Daryl's dad were outnumbered 7-1 in Sydney, and in Brisbane there were 10 family members marching with every veteran. While some Australians see Anzac Day as a kind of family day where they join in, wave flags and celebrate their national identity, others like Bill Denny, who organises Anzac Day in Adelaide, says it's not a carnival.
My grandfather was a veteran in World War I, and my father was a veteran of World War II, and I was a veteran of Vietnam. But through my own experience, I've come to understand just what a sacrifice active service is.
In a decision that's led to anger from some people, Bill is telling marshals to take a tough line. If there are too many relatives, they'll be told to move to the back, behind the veterans. He also wants to see an end to the drunkenness that's become part of Anzac Day over the years.
I get saddened when I see this, I call it a misplaced sense of entitlement by the young people in some ways. It's the way they think Anzac Day is. And I feel that unless they're guided, the young will start to see Anzac Day as a pageant, nothing more than an opportunity for a few beers and can use that expression of Aussie, 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 oi, 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 you know, standing there with their flags around their shoulders. I don't know if you remember the Cronulla riots, but that was the worst expression of the use of the word Anzac with the Cronulla riots a few years ago, which brought in all sense of terrible racism and stupidity and drunkenness. And in the middle of that, we had people yelling out, "We're Anzacs," you know, and I thought at the time it would make every Anzac turn in his grave to see that, the most appalling.
This is the commemoration of Greek National Day, held at the Shrine of Remembrance in the run-up to Anzac Day. Melbourne has the third largest Greek population in the world, after Athens and Thessaloniki, and many of the Greek war veterans here will also march on Sunday.
My name is Stephen Kiritsis.
And you're here for Greek National Day today.
Correct. I think all commemorative days are very important to remember all the fallen, not only the soldiers, but the women, civilians, children. I think it's very important. I know the Greek Return and Services League marches every year. Keep in mind that Australia was in Greece in the Second World War, along with the Anzacs, and it's very important to take part as well.
That report from Sharon Maskell. Don't forget to check out our website, where you can see photos of some of our guests and hear highlights of previous programmes. It's well worth going just to hear the piece about the Charlie Chaplin fanatics from India who dress like their hero and even try to walk like him. And there are photos of them in action at bbcworldservice.com/outlook. But that's all from today's programme. I'm Matthew Bannister. Asma Mir will be here with the next edition of Outlook from the BBC World Service. Do join her if you can.